G'day everyone, and welcome to another episode of A Place to Call Home podcast. On this episode, I chat to a good friend, Tom Fates. Now, Tom doesn't know it yet, but he's about to become my resident ag tech guru, and hopefully I can get him on a few future podcasts as we continue this journey. Now, Tom and I have known each other for a while through my previous career, and also when I was working at home here, we did a fair bit getting the water medication going. And I've really enjoyed chatting to Tom, and he is full of wisdom and knowledge of not only the ag tech space, but agriculture in general in Australia. And he's a really interesting guy. This episode is great for anyone just starting out on their land ownership journey. And I suppose they're getting barraged by all these different ag tech companies wanting to chat to you and obviously wanting you to spend their dollar with them. So this is a great way and a bit of impartial advice that Tom shares of ways to deal with those people, and also a way to actually analyze what products would suit you and your business a lot better. I really hope you enjoy this episode, and if you do, be sure to give us a follow and share it with some friends and family. And one last thing, I just want to say a big thank you to this episode's sponsor, which is InSolution. InSolution is a medicated business that is looking to help northern beef producers with any of their inquiries when it comes to water medication. You can find them on Facebook, and don't be afraid to reach out and start a conversation with the team. Thank you very much and enjoy. Tom, thank you very much for jumping on the Place to Call Home podcast. Mate, before we get too far into the conversation, can you tell me bit more about yourself?
Yeah, mate. Firstly, thanks for having me on the pod machine, Sam. Long time listener, first time guest, so feeling very, very honoured to get the call up. But name's Tom Fates. Grew up in Brisbane, so hopefully you and your audience don't hold that against me too much. I'm a husband of a beautiful wife named Erin, and father to two little boys, Sam and Lockie. And although I haven't really ever worked on a farm, pretty much my whole career to date has been involved in agriculture in some capacity. And in keeping with the theme of your podcast, it's Erin and my dream to one day get on the land, not in a capacity that we're going to derive our main income from it, but because we love it and, we want to have that opportunity to live on a block of land and all the lifestyle benefits that come with it.
Mate, thank you. That's a good intro, mate, good intro. It's always you didn't throw me under the bus too, so that's a bonus. So far the last couple of guests have done that, so they've thrown something in there. Mate,
easy to do, mate, but I'll leave that to other people.
Mate, going back to the start, you already said, like, you know, you didn't grow up on the land, but how were you connected to the land, or were you connected in any way, shape or form?
Yeah, mate, definitely. So, both my parents are from the bush. So my mum grew up in a little town near Northam in WA. I forget the name of the town, so I've failed her once again. But so my dad also grew up in the bush. He and his family are from Eidsvold. So he grew up there on a property called Belvedere. And Belvedere is actually the farming country parcel of land, part of Eidsvold Station. Mm-hmm. So dad tells the yarn that in the very early 60s, my granddad, David Fates, he went out there with my grandma and obviously dad as a baby, and on a handshake agreement with the Joyces, stayed at Belvedere for 50 years, farming it and managing all of that country for them. So that was where dad grew up, and up until sort of pretty close to sort of 2010, around then, I think it was, maybe around 2008, just after I left high school, really. That was when my grandparents, who lived there pretty much their whole working life, finally retired and left. But up until that time, my whole childhood, me and my siblings, I would say that sort of three out of every four school holidays during the year, we would go out to Belvedere and spend time there. And, you know, at the time I didn't really sort of view it as, you know, I love farming in the sense that this is what I want to do as a job, but I definitely think that I enjoyed the experience going out there, and that's probably where the seed was planted, I'd say. But, yeah, like I said, it was more around just going out there and doing fun stuff that we couldn't do in the city, like, you know, help our granddad in the tractor and get to drive utes and vehicles around the place, you know, at a young age and shoot guns. And so my sort of my feelings around agriculture was more around that rather than, you know, this is a career type thing. But, yeah, that's our story and our background, and very fortunate to have had that. And that's probably, like I said, what sort of set me on that trajectory.
Mate, it seems very early on, you know, you develop this connection to the land, and I suppose, like, what grew out of that? Like, you know, you said you're on the pathway to hopefully one day owning a bit of dirt. What is when did you first come to that decision, and what were some of those drivers?
Yeah, probably all of that. Like, just definitely that early stage. And if I can just take a step back, like, because it was never a property that my family owned, they leased it the whole time. All my dad, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying this, all he wanted to do when he grew up and finished boarding school was he just wanted to go back home and work on the farm. But my granddad basically told him he had to go and get himself educated, which he did, and that's how he sort of we ended up on the trajectory of you know, moving to the city. But certainly just, you know, seeing firstly his love for the land, and then just through all walks of life, the connections that I've made, and all, you know, predominantly all my mates, they've all come from farming and families, and just seeing the lifestyle that they have and what they grow up in, and also just the enjoyment and also just the attachment to it. Plus the other thing is I probably should mention, Erin, my wife's also from the country. So she grew up on a little block down in right on the border of New South Wales and Victoria in Findlay. So she's also got that connection as well. And we're both at a stage where we don't really want to live in the inner city. She had a similar upbringing to me of enjoying the freedom of roaming around and riding motorbikes and being around, you know, livestock and animals. And we really enjoy that, and we want our boys to, you know, eventually have that connection to it as well, and have the opportunity to do that. So I think just hasn't been one singular event, but just, yeah, the way that we've sort of, my life sort of evolved, that's always been sort of a cornerstone and a touch point that's sort of embedded in me. And, yeah, that's our ultimate goal, in keeping with the theme of your podcast, get our own patch of dirt to call home one day.
Hey, it's it is interesting. And one thing, my goal with the podcast is I've tried to keep it looking outside the box. I want to come from a different angle, not the traditional ways that people have come into land ownership or the traditional ways they've come into agriculture. And I've got you on one, yes, to tell your story, but the other side of things that you've actually had a really interesting career, and you've already touched on it previously about not the traditional route to that role of agriculture. And I suppose it is becoming more prominent that more people are doing these other different careers, whether ag tech, you know, agribusiness, what are they doing outside before coming back on the land. And you've had a very interesting career in ag tech and in that space. Can you just tell us a bit more, I suppose, so far what you've been up to in your career journey?
Yeah, sure, mate. So ag tech is it is my passion. Like I just think it's just such a huge potential driver of productivity and innovation and efficiency in ag, particularly in grazing. There's just so much opportunity to not really do huge game-breaking things. Like I'm not talking, you know, AI and robots and stuff, like just basic little simple things that just make life a bit easier. So, yeah, that's been sort of what I've been doing for probably the last 7 years nearly, I'd say. But before that, I had probably my first couple of stints out of uni was more in the agribusiness side of things and commodity trading. But funnily enough, that sort of set me up really well for a career in ag tech, because a lot of the skills that you learn in that pretty cutthroat sort of trading environment are great skills for business in general, particularly sales. So yeah, so that's where I started. Don't know if I'm allowed to sort of indulge you in the whole story or how much what our time constraints are, but yeah, sort of pretty similar to you, really, Sam. Like we went to the same school, one grade apart. Your year was famous for having Quade Cooper. Our year was famous because we were at that time the dumbest OP results in history. So on the back of that, I was sort of hoping to get a high enough OP that I could get into law. And I really feel like, particularly in our school, and I don't know if this is sort of similar to what some of your audience have experienced, but it was really, you know, you're either smart enough to go and do medicine or engineering or law, or some sort of discipline to get into those things eventually, or you're a bush kid and you go home and work on the farm. And then everything else was like, oh, well, you may as well go and do a trade. And by the way, we'll politely ask you not to sit the QCS. but I feel like I was sort of in no man's land for that because I was obviously an absolutely mediocre battler academically, but didn't have interest in a trade at that time in our life. Dad ran a pest control business. So as much as I had the experience in the bush, I also spent a lot of time helping him on building sites and stuff, and just that didn't interest me at all. But you know, now knowing what I know now, I like the amount of opportunities in business generally, but particularly in ag post farm gate, there's huge job opportunities there, and I'm not talking about like feel good fluffy stuff, like good high-paying jobs, because everyone's got to eat and be clothed. And so the people making decisions that, you know, keep that ticking over, they're highly valued skilled jobs where you can have very successful careers. I think that the schools in particular need to do more to promote that. Yeah. That was a bit of a tangent, sorry. So after school, I didn't know what I was going to do, and I ended up doing a gap year where I went to England for a year playing rugby. And when I went over there, I was meant to do building labourer sort of work for a bloke. And the club that I was playing for put us like they put us in touch with people we could do work with. Anyway, about a month before we set off to go and live the dream, the GFC hit. So all the building work sort of finished up, and I ended up having to work in a dairy factory making like processed cheese and you know, dairy ingredients from the local milk. And at the time, it wasn't very good. But in hindsight, it really sort of sparked a bit of interest in me. And, you know, we've got to take this commodity item and make a product and add value somehow. But we've got to also see, you know, where does this fit in the market? Like, is it a premium product that we can get a premium price? Or, Is it a commodity thing where we are the cheapest producer of it? Who do we partner with? So all those sort of things, like I could see those sort of things happening around me. And so when I got back from England, I had a failed attempt at trying to get into ADFA, just missed out at the last thing. And so I was sitting around thinking, well, what am I going to do now? And Dad sort of said to me, well, why don't you go to Gatton? You know, you've got your farming background. You talked to me about, you know, what you learn over there in Ledbury. Like, you know, that might be something up your alley. And yeah, so I thought, why not go to Gatton and had a look at some of the courses there. And agribusiness was really sort of fit in with some of that higher level thinking that interests me. And so yeah, I went out there and lo and behold, there was a heap of old schoolmates there, and so it ended up being one of the best decisions I ever made. And at the time, I was doing animal science and agribusiness, but I got about one lecture through floral formulas, cutting up flowers in biology, and thought, stuff this, I'm just going to do agribusiness. So I finished there, and then, yeah, I went straight into a graduate role with a small meat and grain trading business. Worked there for 2 years, and like I sort of mentioned earlier, was very green at the time and very shy, but really got thrown in the deep end there and forced to get on the phone, pick up the phone and try and make business happen, make deals happen, and deal with a lot of conflict as well. So that really, really helped in sort of developing my career trajectory. So I was there for about 2 years. That was a great experience. And then I actually then got an opportunity came up with one of your in-laws, funnily enough, to do commodity trading but in fresh produce. And so I jumped ship over to there and did 2 years there. And that was a good stepping stone again, because I saw a totally different side to ag that, you know, we know is there, but that fresh produce game is tough business. It's very hard, very transactional, very, very cutthroat. And you're dealing with a highly perishable product. So, yeah, when problems happen, the clock is definitely ticking. So yeah, but I guess in trying to keep it in the theme of your podcast, Sam, each you know, along that whole journey, I was constantly in touch with you know, farmers and the land still, and really just envied you know, people who were on the land, getting to make decisions, and they seem to be the ones who were not only just having all the fun, but also seem to have a lot more of the industry power and clout, I guess. Mm. So I really wanted to find a way to get involved in that. So yeah, I did that. That was about 5 years after uni, and then as luck would have it, I wanted a change. I really wasn't getting fulfillment. And a lot of my friends at this stage had gone home, and they were either back home, you know, stepping up and helping to manage their place, or they'd gone and become managers, you know, at in the corporate ag places. And they were all starting to really kick goals and things. And I was starting to feel a little bit, you know, left behind. And, you know, when's my turn going to be to sort of do something?
Looking over the fence.
Yeah, that was my metaphorical looking over the fence moment. But yeah, as luck would have it, an opportunity came up in Toowoomba, and it was an ag tech startup by a father and son team who had developed a little widget, I guess, and they wanted to put someone on young and keen to basically step in and run it full time for them and grow it and see where it took. So I reached out to them and said, yeah, I'd love the opportunity to do that. And they were good enough to give me a go. And that was pretty much all it was when my foray into ag tech started then. And yeah, that it really uncovered a passion that I have. And yeah, the rest is history.
But it's an interesting journey that you've had. I think it's really cool to highlight where you've come from and how just agriculture has kept pulling you back and pulling you back. And going on to the ag tech conversation a bit, one thing that I think might be interesting for a few of the listeners and stuff is that I see a lot of people these days, like there's a lot of stuff out there, a lot of ag tech getting pushed for us to use, and as producers or people getting going in land, it's almost overwhelming the amount of stuff that people say that we need to run a business. What have you seen, what have you seen that people have embraced in that technology space? And what are some of those things they're supposed to be aware of when they do start stepping down the track of looking into ag tech as a producer?
Oh, mate, it's a great question. And the beauty of where I am now, sitting where I am, I'm not trying to sell anything at the moment. I can be a bit more objective about it. But I think the ultimate question that producers need to ask themselves is, will this add value to, firstly, our operation? But I think something that often gets overlooked that probably should also be part of the equation as well is, will it add value to my life?
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is sometimes some things don't stack up when you do the numbers on a spreadsheet. But for example, can you really put a price on, say, putting a water monitor on your tank and then that giving you the flexibility to jump in the car and drive to town for the weekend to watch the kids play footy?
Yeah.
Like, that might not stack up on the spreadsheet, but how much does that improve yours and your family's quality of life? So there's little things like that as well that I think are just as important as, you know, looking at, you know, how does us improve our bottom line? And that's the beauty of ag tech. You know, there's different ways that you can evaluate the value proposition. But, yeah, as I said earlier, probably the number one thing is, you know, starting and looking at what you're doing and thinking, you know, where's the low-hanging fruit in our operation that, you know, we could possibly adopt something that's going to, you know, make it a little bit easier or increase our profitability a bit or add some sort of value to what we're doing and make an improvement. That's probably the first place to look. And then the easiest thing then is just to, once you've identified those points in your business, then you start doing your research. Okay, well, what products are out there that we can look at? And then, you know, it's just a matter, I think, of rather than Googling these places and trying to just do it all online, just pick up the phone and talk to them. Ask them to come out and visit your operation and take them for a drive and get to know the person as much as the product. Because in a lot of cases, a lot of these ag tech businesses are similar to me, that they're men and women who grow up with an affiliation or love of the country, and they're trying to do their bit to put their stamp on the industry and make it better. I know from my experience, by far the best part of the job was the opportunity to get out on farm and spend time with my customers and with their families and get to know them and get to identify the points and the pain points in their operation where our products could really make a difference. And that was truly the special part of the job. And I've got now lifelong friends who I've made through that process. Yeah. So yeah, that would be my suggestion is identify those areas in the business where there is an opportunity to do things a bit better and then research the companies who might have solutions and talk to them, pick up the phone and talk to them and just get a feel for not only their product, but also the people behind it.
This episode of A Place to Call Home podcast is brought to you by InSolution. InSolution is a business that specializes in low-cost and affordable solutions for northern beef producers interested in implementing water medication as a supplementary feed strategy. They utilize existing products and systems already on the market and adapt them to your specific needs and requirements. By doing this, they are able to keep the cost to an absolute minimum, ensuring that the savings and benefits end up in your bottom line. There are no subscriptions, confusing or hidden fees with what they do. They just focus on getting the limiting nutrition required by livestock into their drinking water safely and at the lowest possible cost. For more information, be sure to check out the InSolution Facebook page, where you can reach out and organise a chat with the friendly team.
As a young person and, you know, say we're at a field day or something like that, or even we're having someone cold calling you, coming out, some of these salespeople, what are some questions I suppose we should be asking about their product? Like, I know, let's just use water monitors for an example. I think there is a lot of companies out there right now that are selling a product, like a water monitoring product. But what are some questions we should be asking to see which one would best suit our operation?
Oh, mate, I think really that there's the, obviously the technical questions about the product itself. It's hard to be to generalize, but yeah, like you take your water monitoring example, like you probably want to know, you know, how is the what is the data that it or what does it transmit its data over? Is it satellite? Is it Wi-Fi? Is it cellular? Obviously, you need to know what the cost is. You need to know how easy it is to install, what the backup service is like, just all those, you know, technical questions. But I think probably the key question is, and I'm sort of repeating myself here, but I think it's important to also, you know, get a feel for the company that you're dealing with and just see how much they actually really they understand your business and your industry. A lot of the issues I see with a lot of ag tech companies is it's a solution that's being created for not necessarily a problem that needed to be addressed.
Yeah.
100%. So, you know, like you can, a product might have the greatest specs in the world, but if it's not really moving the needle for you in your business, it's sort of, you know, it's going to be hard to make it, to justify it, make it stack up. And, you know, it's hard to tease that information, you know, out of, you know, when you're having this conversation just by asking about the specs, but you can really, really get a sixth sense for, you know, that this company understands my problems and concerns by just talking to them and getting them a feel like, do they understand what it's like to actually have to get in a ute and do a run around the paddock checking waters and opening gates and in the stinking heat on Christmas Eve when you just want to be sitting there having a beer, but all of a sudden the troughs are empty and the cattle are starting to get a bit bomby? Like, do they understand how much pressure and how stressful that is? A lot of the times, you know, a geek, I use that word with the utmost respect, a geek wearing a skivvy in Sydney who's developed some funky SaaS software program, they don't really understand that. So you can and, you know, they can answer the question technically, but having that sense that the provider really has your back, I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah, 100%. I fully agree that there is a bit of disconnect between some of these ag tech companies, and it's really quite hard trying to not throw anyone under the bus and then the producers on the ground. And I think it's important for us as producers, as young people, to ask them to actually realise, see if those companies actually know what it's like to be on the ground, or they have that experience, or they have some form of knowledge when it comes, like you said, have they ever opened a gate? I think in my role currently, I was put under, I think, one of the proper tests that anyone could do is I went out and visited this person And she took me up through the back paddock. We were checking out some of the infrastructure work that she's done. And she took me up to a Cocky's gate. And having grown up, I do know how to open a wire gate. So it made it easier. But she made the comment. She said, she's as I hopped back in, she's like, yeah, that's my trial. That's to see if they actually have any knowledge or they know what they're doing. Like, it's just
Mate. I had plenty of those. And, the early days, the old Cocky's gate used to stump me. But now by these days, I just confidently walk up and open and close them, no problems at all. But, yeah, you're right. It is definitely a it's a sign of kudos when you're a bloke from the city who can operate a Cocky's gate.
Mate, touching on Acton, before I get too far, I kind of want to also, you mentioned before, and I think it was a good angle to think of, is of talking about the benefits of introducing ag tech into your business. And I suppose, what are some of those that you've seen? And you mentioned just before those non-financial ones. Can you give us a few more examples of those? Like you mentioned just before of how being able to go to watch your kids play soccer or something like that, because you do have something in place. Is there anything like that, the intangibles that we can kind of, that you've seen that's come up from people benefiting from adopting some technology?
Oh, mate, just using the water monitoring example, like I can't even begin to fathom the amount of times I've spoken to people who have had big disasters avoided because they've had a monitor in place that's alerted them to an issue and they've been able to get there and nip that in the bud before it's become a disaster. So I think that's all pretty well documented. Just to take a step back, mate, so the first ag tech company I worked for was a water medication company. They're still in operation now. And during that time, there was a lot of things coming through that was around monitoring and a lot of software as a service businesses, so data entry and analytics. For me, water medication was such a huge opportunity because no one was doing it. And, in the livestock industry particularly, like it's one of those things that's always sort of amused me to some degree that we'll spend, as an industry, we'll spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on genetics, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on infrastructure improvements. But our nutrition that we give our cattle is boiled down to throwing a couple of bags of lick on the back of the ute and driving around and throwing them on the ground. So to me, there was a huge opportunity there to do that a bit better. And over time, we actually, in developing our case studies and our trial work to get this this concept and this product going, we had trials up at like Spyglass Station in conjunction with DAF, where we easily saw 15 to 20% live weight gains between our treated versus control lick block groups, big conception and weaning rate increases, huge quantifiable tangible benefits like that. You throw that in with the sometimes hard to quantify, but we know that there are benefit things like wear and tear on vehicles and the time not having to actually go around and put lick out. You put that in conjunction with having a couple of monitors on your tanks monitoring your water, and all of a sudden that's almost paid for not having a staff member for a year, and it frees up time to, if you want to work in your business or on your business rather than in your business, or like we said before, like spend more time with your family. Or focus on other avenues that can, generate income for you. I've got some mates who do, real estate and that sort of thing. And having, these tools, these ag tech tools on farm allows them to do those sorts of things. There's heaps of benefits there. But, again, it'll come back to the individual young person on farm and being able to identify, where is the low hanging fruit and in pain point in our operation currently that we can, implement something that might alleviate that or free up the time or add value or add a bit of extra to the bottom line.
Yeah. I think that water medication is an interesting one. I know we do it at home at mum and dad's property there. And actually that's what we're pretty well, we had a bit to do with you back in the day for that. And it was great, greatly improved. Not only, I suppose, the figures wise, it was a cheaper input cost that we had for our cattle. You'd also have everyone, all the animals drinking out of the water. And, you know, you could actually measure what their intake is. So, you know, about how much exactly what they're getting, which is some really cool stuff to have on hand and be able to make some better decisions with. But like for you, you've mentioned several times, I suppose, but what is the best bang for buck for a young person starting out in ag tech right now? Yeah.
As in a young producer.
Yeah, a young producer implementing something, what would be their best bang for the buck if they are looking to head down that route?
I mean, I'm obviously biased. I think medicators are obviously a great way. That's my passion. But it you know, some people are very much numbers-based people. So they might get a huge amount of value out of a program like, you know, a farm management program like Black Box or AgriWeb. So they're a great way to, you know, really dive into numbers and start actually measuring what you're doing. So I can't speak highly enough of those sorts of things. And then there's obviously your monitoring side. You know, there's companies out there like FarmBot and AgBot. FarmBot is very, very highly respected company that's been doing what they've been doing now for a number of years. But now there's other, you know, and they've sort of been the trailblazer that's got its going, observing as well. But now there's other companies out there that are doing an excellent job as well and at very affordable prices, such as AgBot. So if being able to cut down those, you know, those time-consuming, I use this word with the greatest respect, but those time-consuming lower value jobs like having to go and check waters, like if freeing up the time to do something else and not having to do that is important to you, then, yeah, those sorts of things are an excellent bang for buck. And then it's just a matter of, you know, reaching out to those companies and seeing what's more important, like the lower cost option or the higher value option. But, yeah, they're excellent. On the farming side of things, I know that there's lots of very cool things coming along. Swarm Farm Robotics, they've got their fully autonomous spraying robots and farming robots. I don't know whether or not a young person starting out, you know, that's going to be something that they're going to be able to get their teeth into straight away. But, you know, as we see the price for all these technologies start to scale, they'll become more affordable and viable. Obviously, what your mate Luke Chaplin's doing with Sky Kelpie drones, I think, you know, that there'll come a time where there's a tipping point where wide-scale adoption of that happens. I think that'll be awesome. But again, like it comes back to the individual what they see is you know, a lower value sort of pain point that they could implement something that is going to give them, you know, a return or a benefit or add value. They're sort of the things that I would suggest to look at. Work out what's important. You know, are you a numbers person? You need help with that. Are you a time efficiency person? Do you need to cut down on some of the lower value jobs and what are out there? Or are you a big picture toys person? Like, you know, that might be something that you're happy to buy a $60,000 drone and go for it and take that around the paddock and muster sheep because that's what you enjoy. I think the thing to remember is ag tech's such a loose word, but you take helicopters, for example. Helicopters were not invented to muster Brahmins up in the north. But the industry adopted it because they could see the potential of using it and how much value and time and efficiency that created for the industry. And I think that that'll be the thing that drives ag tech, you know, as we go forward. It'll be something that's used somewhere else that all of a sudden has huge positive implications for the bush, and it'll be grabbed and adopted widely. And again, we'll see more productivity as a result.
Mate, that's a bloody good advice. I had a lot to think on for young people at the moment, definitely kicking off on their journey. I'm going to flick the switch a bit, and because I reckon I want to jump back into the conversation about you and chasing your own dream of finding your place to call home. You've actually been doing a lot of outside investing to build up asset to hopefully one day achieve that and reach your goal. Can you tell us a bit more about, I suppose, you starting out and what type of stuff have you looked into? Have you done some share investing? Have you done some real estate investing? And like, how has that benefited, or how have you gone about those things?
Yeah, mate. So I have started doing that. It sort of happened by accident, but it's been a very positive accident. With the end point in mind is Aaron and I want to build a portfolio and enough equity to be able to eventually, you know, get a little block. And, you know, our version of a place to call home, as I mentioned at the start of the show, is not to derive income from it, but it's just to, you know, run a couple of cows, enough room for motorbikes and be able to, be able to just pretend to be a cowboy for a bit, but we'll still definitely work full time. But yeah, we were sort of pretty lucky when I moved to Toowoomba. My boss at the time, his main business was property development, and he was generous enough to get me a good deal on a block in Withcott. So you know, timing's everything. It was just before the Banking Royal Commission, so with a pretty you know, very unglorified salary and only a $10,000 deposit, I was able to use the first homeowner's grant to build a house on this block. And this was just before the Royal Commission, so after that they tightened lending and there's no way I would have been able to do that. But yeah, so that was my foot in the door. And then, as we know, property prices then, you know, went through the roof, particularly in COVID. So I was able to build a lot of equity into that house quite quickly. Then when Aaron and I got together and were serious and had our first boy, she also had built up enough savings as well that she was very financially secure. So we were able to utilize her savings to put a deposit on a investment house property in Toowoomba.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our second house. And that was, again, lucky timing just before COVID. We got that house and then COVID hit, and the equity in that house and the Withcott took off again. And, we had good equity in the house, but I think everyone sort of pats themselves on the back when they achieve equity, but it's really just a paper value. Yep. So we were sitting on the equity on these two properties and we thought, well, we might as well do something with it. So we decided that we'd try and use the equity to buy a third house. And at the start of this year, we did do that. So we didn't really need to use any cash to do that. We just used the existing equity in our two properties and use them as security as well to get the third loan. And a bit ambitious, I'd say, given how much interest rates have now crept up, and then Aaron's now not working because we've just had Lockie. So I'm sort of holding the fort. And you just got to remind yourself long term that you know, having property is, you know, a pretty financially astute decision, I think, I hope. And our plan is that once we've sort of regathered ourselves a bit, paid down a bit of debt and built up a bit more equity in our third house, then we'll look to go again. I would love to get some exposure to the Brisbane property market. I think that that's got a lot of growth potential in it left, particularly with Melbourne and Sydney now, you know, quite, it's hard to see how they can continue to sustain the growth that they're doing. And Brisbane's very relatively affordable to those markets. So I can see in the long term a lot of, you know, young families coming up and moving to Brisbane because they can buy an affordable house close to the city. And I see the property market there continuing to grow long term. And then that's obviously going to be underpinned as well by all the economic activity that happens around the Olympics. But I think Southeast Queensland as a whole is, from memory, it's the fastest growing region in Australia in terms of population. So there's huge opportunity there. But yeah, the end goal really is to have enough of a property portfolio and equity there that we can eventually go to the bank and try and find, you know, like a little hobby or lifestyle block, ideally around where we live, close to Toowoomba, maybe somewhere in the Brisbane Valley or the Lockyer Valley or somewhere around there, but, you know, somewhere that we can continue to work where we do, be close to family, but also, yeah, have that opportunity to grow up on the land, run a few cows, ride a few motorbikes and enjoy all the benefits that come with it.
Mate, that was a very good wrap-up of your real estate investing. I had several questions in there I was going to ask, but you pretty well covered them each step along the way. Yeah,
I think, I was just going to say, Sam, like I think the thing that we learned along the way, and maybe this might be of interest to your listeners, is just how favourably the banks view equity in an existing property. Like it almost seems like it's a free kick in building wealth. Like the equity that we built in the house was far more than we could ever have saved. But it was almost like that $200,000 worth of equity was worth more to them than $200,000 worth of cash would have been anyway. Yeah. So it just seems to me like it is a free kick that if you can sustain the cash flow required to get these properties, it's such a potentially long-term great way to build financial wealth and give yourself options, give you and your family options.
Yeah, but it's definitely something we're interested. We're looking at doing some real estate investing in the near future. And it's something that I suppose even with the podcast now, kind of the goal going forward, as I keep bringing in experts that will hopefully help people's journey, is I want to bring in someone that is an expert at real estate investing and also share investing as well. But you know, just both of those can help people along the journey.
Thanks for inviting me on, mate. No, I'm a real estate and share investing expert.
I was going to get a specific one for that. You're my residential ag tech expert, mate. I just wanted to share a bit of your journey as well because I knew you were learning things. Mate, what's next for you guys? Where do you see yourself in 1, 5, 10 years' time?
Oh, mate, I don't have a good answer for that because, honestly, if you had to ask me this question even a year ago, my answer would be so wildly different to where I am now. But I think long term, like Aaron and I love Toowoomba. I think at this stage the goal is to just keep grinding away and try and get onto a place. I don't know whether that's going to be in the next 5 years, 10 years or 30 years, mate, because things change. But, yeah, I think as long as we just continue, you know, being disciplined, keeping to the process, we'll get there and we'll get there whenever that happens. And in between, we'll just take it as it comes, I think.
Mate, and flying on, another one I ask people is, I suppose there's so many different schools out there. Have you done any that have really helped you along your journey so far?
Oh, mate, I've done the So I really enjoyed the RCS course.
Yep.
And the reason I did that was, when I was heavily involved in ag tech, I kept getting a lot of the people would bring up interested in what we were doing were students or recent graduates of RCS. And so I thought there must be something to this. So I decided to do the course, and it just completely opened my mind to, regenerative ag and just the concept of grazing really. I'm probably got people screaming at their phone as they're listening to this, me describe it. But to me, the way I perceived it was, you're really a grass farmer using your livestock as the mechanism to manage your country. And that was a really awesome paradigm shift for me. So I'm really grateful that I got the opportunity to do that course, even though I don't run my own cattle, but just being able to get into that mindset. Another school that I've done that I don't know if many of your audience would know of, but I thoroughly enjoyed it, is the Leadership Beyond the Theory course, which is part of this podcast called No Bullshit Leadership.
Yep.
It's not really ag related, but it's a great course for people who want to get into management, particularly, leading teams and focusing on, getting the people who work under you to focus on the right things that add value, and really, really resonates with me at a time in a tight labor market where people quite often it seems to be all about them. They want the work from home, they want the 100,000 plus salary straight out of uni, and they want a day off for mental health leave. It's a really good it's a really good framework for how to get your team performing well, delivering value and doing what they're meant to do, what they're paid to do, basically, and how to focus on the right things.
Yeah, mate, they are two very interesting courses. And definitely, I haven't heard that one before, so I'm going to do a bit of background research on that after this, I reckon. Mate, I reckon mentors play such a huge part in people's journey. And, like, it's something that I've really leveraged off is having a few people in my corner. Have you had anyone that have helped you along your journey so far?
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of really good mentors. Probably the two that stick in my mind are Mark Peart, no longer work for him and don't really have much to do with him anymore, sadly, but wouldn't be where I am today without him and where he gave me an opportunity to come up and to Toowoomba and work in that ag tech space and being able to, work directly under him for so many years was a huge influence on my life. And secondly would be Dr. Tony Wood, who is a vet, who he was really one of the pioneers of water medication and incredibly smart guy and knowledgeable about ruminant nutrition. So he's also a mentor. But I've had lots of other mentors along the way. And one thing I've learned as well is to me, something that is as important as having a good mentor is being a mentor at the same time. I think there's a lot to be said for you should always have a mentor, but you should also have a young person, that you're also mentoring. There's a lot to be said for that, I think, because there's lots of stuff that you learn and you're always learning, but there's also lots of stuff that you can, no matter where you are in life, you can always impart knowledge onto people coming through, particularly me. Like, I really enjoy being able to help other battlers, mediocre battlers who, like myself, who've had to fight for everything their whole life, have never ever once had anything handed to them, and being able to, you know, show them that, you know, with a bit of grit and determination, there's no reason why you can't sort of do anything yourself.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, as much as you impart that sort of stuff on, you also need a mentor to remind you of that as well when things are tough. So I think, yeah, it's great having good mentors, but it's also great and important to try and take the opportunity to be a mentor when you can.
That's sound advice. Mate, lastly, what would be your one piece of advice to the next generation coming through, whether that is their land ownership journey or even life in general? What is that one piece of advice that you want to hand on?
Oh, mate, getting all philosophical now. mate, I don't know. It's hard. I think one thing that sort of has sort of applied to me recently is in chess, the only move that matters is the next move. So when you make a mistake or something doesn't work out, try not to beat yourself up about it. And it's easy for me to say that because I'm sort of been recently going through this, but the only thing that you can control is what you do next and how you respond to challenges. And you have to just, if you can keep getting up off the ground, dusting yourself off and moving forward, you know, you ultimately, you'll probably be okay. And I think particularly in ag, there seems to be an undertone, and I know it's changing a lot, but there's always been that sort of a little bit of a stigma against people who want to try and do things differently.
We really
need to sort of applaud the people who get in the ring and have a go, because that's how we actually, you know, those people are the ones who actually ultimately, as a collective, make the world a little bit better place and a little bit easier. So, you know, if it wasn't for people who are, you know, not afraid of failure and wanted to have a go, we'd still sort of be throwing sticks at mammoths, probably. that'd be my one advice I'd give is just try not to be afraid of failure, and if it doesn't work out, just think about what a grandmaster chess player would do. He just focuses on the next move.
Sound advice, Top. Look, thank you very much for jumping on board and having a chat today. It has been a cracker of a conversation. I've gotten a lot out of it, so thank you very much.
Thanks, mate. Really, really honoured and proud to be on this famous podcast machine, and you're going really well, mate. Good work spreading the message.
Thank you, buddy.
I really hope you enjoyed this episode of A Place to Call Home podcast. And if you did, I would greatly appreciate it if you could leave us a review and even share it with some friends and family. It's the best way to get the word out there. And I know I say this after every episode, but it greatly helps the algorithms and greatly helps introducing people to the episode. So thank you very much. If you have done that, I greatly appreciate it. And if you haven't, I would greatly appreciate it if you do so. Anyway, to wrap up the episode, I want to leave you with a quote from Tony Robbins. And it goes, "The only impossible journey is the one you never begin." Have a great day.